Welcome to the Tuesday Sports Show.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for listening to the ORN Sport on this Tuesday evening. We will be discussing over the next hour all the sports news from the past week and previewing what's to come over the next 7 days.
Is URN Sport.
Hello and welcome to this Tuesday Sports Show, where we will be covering tonight on this all the events that have occurred over the last week in sports news. We'll be covering the French Open. Following that, we'll be looking at the rugby and what's been going on in the Lions Tour. Then we'll be looking at the triathlon news that's been occurring in Leeds this weekend, in Leeds last weekend. I'm your host, Jeremy Dunn. I'm joined here in the studio, Fred Lloyd Williams, Naomi Stern and Alex Buxton. And so we'll be kicking things off with our discussion on the French Open, and it had to be the story that we all kind of everyone wants to see. But Rafael Nadal completed Le Decima on clay. He won his 10th French Open and now holds the title of the undisputed King of Clay. We have probably a lot to discuss about this, because it was we can look back on the tournament as a whole, but we'll start off by kind of our own individual thoughts on the final and what we thought of the game. So Naomi, why don't you kick us off with what you thought of both the final and also probably the tournament as a whole?
I thought the final was an incredible spectacle for a neutral, but also for a Nadal fan. Nadal was just incredible, and he was simply too good for Wawrinka. He won in straight sets, 6-2, 6-3, 6-1. He was just too strong and powerful. And also, Wawrinka was very tired from the Murray match and his semi-final, so I don't think he had enough energy left in him to compete with Rafa. But also, the whole tournament, Nadal played so well. He didn't drop a set throughout the tournament and only conceded 35 games. And I think Nadal was definitely back to his best now.
I agree. I mean, on Nadal's serve, Wawrinka almost won no points. he won, I think, about 2 points in the first three games of Nadal's serve. It was pretty dominant. And it was only a matter of time, I feel, before Nadal broke him. And then it sort of led on from there. Sort of. And then again, he did win one more game every set, I think, didn't he? All the way around. He lost one more game every set.
Yeah, he was. He gained one back at the start. It was 6-2, then it went to 6-3, so he was doing well. But then at the end, it petered out, unfortunately, a little bit. So he had a bit of a yo-yo performance, I think it's safe to say.
I think he perhaps had just lost it by the end, I feel.
I mean, Nadal, we all expected him to win, to be honest. He's been having this is his 10th title, and he's only 31, so that shows how much of an achievement that is. And, I mean, I think we all wanted it to be a bigger game. You always wanted it to be a five-set thriller, but Nadal was simply too good. I mean, the commentator said at the start of the game that it was quite hot and that those conditions would suit Nadal, because Nadal is a bit of a specimen, whereas we said Savinka is not the fittest. So, yeah, Nadal had quite an easy tournament. He won pretty much, well, I think he won every single set and didn't drop a set. So, I think the result was as expected.
Yeah, unprecedented achievement, though, for him, isn't it? His 10th win on clay. You know, it's a fantastic thing. Nadal, after the game, came up with a couple of comments that he was saying. The first one saying, you know, in 2005, when he won it the first time back in 2005, he said, you know, I didn't think in 2017 I'd still be playing. I thought I'd be fishing on a boat in Mallorca, which sounds a rather nice prospect, I think, for all of us, to be fair. But that 10th win, you know, Borg is the one that's previously sort of has them the most ahead of him in the tennis open era on six, but he's now putting some pretty clear water before him. And the title of King of Clay, I think it's safe to say we all are agreement that that is completely well deserved. And there's, I mean, we talk about how much of a great athlete and, you know, spectator, for example, Federer has been, particularly at Wimbledon. But when you look at Roland Garros, there is only really, I think, now one name that will stick out as the true master there.
And the thing is, he could have won more. I mean, he won it for nine consecutive years in 2005 and 2014. And I'd argue, and I think I know people would struggle to contend with this, if he hadn't had a few injury problems in the gap between 2014 and 17, he could have definitely added it to this title. And I don't think we'll ever see a player in probably our lifetime who will be this dominant on one tournament.
But I also think that's what makes it so amazing, because he was crying, I think, last year when he came off court at Roland Garros, and it just shows the comeback he's made this year. to be in the Australian Open final on her hard court and to not drop a set throughout the tournament and win. And for him to come back the way he has done has been incredible. Thanks to his coach, Carlos Moya and Tony Nadal, he's just been incredible.
Yeah, he's only entered Roland Garros 11 times. He's lost once. That's ridiculous. His pre-served notion's a bit annoying, I'll be honest, with tucking his hair behind his ears and so on. That was really getting on my nerves. But no, in terms of tennis playing, oh, goodness me.
The forehand, though, I don't know if any of you watched the match. There was one shot he did 99 miles per hour. Yeah. He ran from the left side of the court to the right. And it's the shot they're talking about. They say it's one of the best shots ever on clay, which he performed in the final. Although he didn't win that game, that was the shot that they will be talking about from that match.
I think apparently about the heat as well. You talked about the heat. Apparently it made the ball bounce slightly higher. And with the ball bouncing higher, Wawrinka has like a one-handed backhand, doesn't he, I think?
Yeah.
And that was made it harder for him to return it, apparently, says the commentators.
Yeah, they said Nadal's never lost, I think, on clay against a one-handed left...
I mean, he's only lost once, too. But yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it's even the fact that Stan Wawrinka didn't play that well. I mean, he didn't have his best game, and I've seen him play in other tournaments, and he's obviously a Grand Slam winner. He's nothing to be sniffed at, but Nadal was so good that game. I mean, in the point that you're talking about, it wasn't like he had just hit that 90 mile an hour shot off like an easy shot from Wawrinka. He was having to cover a lot of ground, and not many people actually expect him to make the shot, let alone be able to hit a winner. So
right in the corner.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
I think it's a testament to how good Nadal is. I think if he hadn't had his injuries, he could have been probably challenged Federer's record and overall, because it wasn't just clay. I think that would be kind of taken away some of his achievements. He's won, I think, I'm assuming, every single one of the Grand Slams. Yeah. And he would definitely be up there with Federer, if not surpassing him, in my opinion.
Yeah, he's on 15 now. He's only three away still, so who knows what could happen.
Do you think part of the sporting prowess, though, is how your ability to continue doing the sport? So Nadal's, part of his problem has been getting injured, whereas Federer's almost been almost uninjured. Do you think it's part of them?
I think it's a difference in style, to be honest. Yeah. Nadal is really fast-paced. He involves a lot of running, but obviously Federer doesn't do that. He's more kind of...
Graceful.
Yeah, I think that's the perfect way to sum it up. So I think that does lead to some more injuries to Nadal, but I don't think you can really blame a player for the injuries they suffer in their career. And I still think, regardless, he's going to be known as one of the greatest of all time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Definitely.
Hi, this is Jeff Selling from Sky Sports, and you're listening to URN Sport.
Thanks, Jeff. So you're joined here back on the Tuesday Sports Show. But now we're going to then move on to the rugby action that's been going on over the last couple of days, specifically the Lions Tour. And there has been a fair bit of action that's been going on, it's safe to say, hasn't there, Fred? I mean, the main game, I think, that we probably want to touch on as Lions fans has to be the match against Crusaders, which they played on Saturday, I believe. And a good victory for them. I don't want to say comfortable, because the scoreline can be a little bit deceptive, but a strong victory, I think, for the tourists down there.
I think a strong victory in comparison to the game they had before that. I mean, I'm not going to take anything away. We won. That's always going to be good. But the fact we didn't score a try. I mean, that's really not massively promising, and we haven't looked very good in attack all the way throughout any of these matches, in my opinion. A defence, on the other hand, that's a very good aspect. The Crusaders, on average, are scoring about 39 points per game. This game is called three. They're one of the best sides in those four nations that play in the Super League. Was it four or three? I can't remember.
They're certainly one of the strongest sides.
They are undoubtedly one of the strongest sides that the Lions are going to play before New Zealand. So I think that's promising. I think there's definitely room to build as well. That might not necessarily be our strongest side we put out.
But I would argue we are quite a gritty side in general compared to New Zealand. I mean, they do like to play the kind of free-flowing rugby, while we have always been a bit more... I've always found it a bit boring to watch, personally. But a win's a win in my eyes. And as you said, to limit them to only 3 points is pretty impressive against one of the best teams, with not our standout team playing. So I think it's definitely good preparation for the main test.
Yeah, I mean, that defensive achievement, I think, is certainly what they'll be taking away as the positive to shut out the Crusaders, a team that have been compared by some to be sort of the rugby world's equivalent of Real Madrid. They are a very attractive attacking side and very good mode to watch. Like you said there, Fred, the amount which they average per game is, frankly, extremely impressive for a rugby team in a very rugby-focused country as well. But the fact that they generate so many points, but also they have one of the big names as well, when it comes to rugby. And full credit to the Lions for that victory in terms of shutting them out. However, unfortunately, to take a bit of the mood away from them, it wasn't a very good week. I mean, they've had an up and down start. We covered the first match against Barbarians, but the Blues, when they played there, now that was an unfortunate loss for them. The game finished 22-16 to the home team. Disappointment, I think it's safe to say, for the Lions, that is meant to be the weakest team as well. Apparently they are meant to be facing during this tour. I mean, they're all very high caliber teams, so I suppose when you're having to look at one which is weak, then it's a bit harsh to pick out the Blues. But yeah, defeat does send then mixed messages back from the tour that's going on down there. They can play well, really well one game, are they going to play really well next game? I mean, I know you and I, before, Fred, we were saying that in some ways we'd rather that if they lost all these matches, okay, so long as they win the test against New Zealand.
I think they learn a lot more from the losses here than they would do again. I mean, you can't learn in the space of a week if you lose to New Zealand the first test. You've got to come really fast. But if you play this Blues game as they did and they lost, they're going to think, oh, the people we put out there, that team probably won't be the selection we're going to have. Out of the 40, 43, 45 players that they have out there, they're not going to pick Dan Bigger. I'm hoping, anyway. They're not going to pick him in the actual tests. Although he didn't last very long, to be fair. And he's one of the injury concerns, possibly. But no, I think that the loss against the Blues actually did quite a lot of good. Despite, I mean, the only thing I don't think it did, the only thing I don't find helpful is the abuse almost that the Lions get, especially online. The online media just hammer them non-stop just because these are the so-called best players we can bring in the Northern Hemisphere against New Zealand, and they're not hammering every single side they come across. I feel the expectation upon them is getting to the bit way too much, honestly. They've played together for about 3 weeks. But then again, they should be doing better overall.
Yeah, and I think you're also saying some of the best players in the Northern Hemisphere, but I mean, the Blues had one of the best players in the Southern Hemisphere in the form of Sonny Bill Williams. Ooh, so yeah. I don't think there's anything really that wrong with losing against them. We're playing not our strongest side. Obviously, it's just testing some of the players out, getting them a run out for the big test games. And they might be the worst Super League team, but they're not. That's the worst out of a very, very good bunch, as you said. So I think at the moment, these results aren't that important. It's more about the performances, as Fred said, learning about the team, learning from the mistakes. So when we do play against the bigger teams like New Zealand, we will be better prepared, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully when those games roll around, we will be in a much better state to, when obviously to begin the test against them. The first match against the New Zealand will be on the 24th of June, so it's coming up, and you know they are basically down in New Zealand for a whole month, the team, so hopefully by then they will, of course, have the full time to acclimatise, prep themselves and get ready. But the critical thing as well for that is the longer you are down there, the longer you're competing in sport, it's the old thing that will happen, is that injuries are bound to occur plenty. Now, the first bit of injury news that we're going to just touch on is Sam Warburton. Now, he's apparently recovering. He's on his way back to potentially being ready. He suffered an ankle injury, which has kept him out of the team for quite a lot of it. He hasn't had that much game time since he first picked up this knock during the second game of this season's Six Nations. So, quite a while he's been out. Now, there's been sort of a bit of mixed messages coming out. Some reports say that he thinks he could lead. He's meant to have commented that he could potentially lead the squad in the next match. Some have said that maybe he's going to sit it out and wait because he's conceded that he might not be in a good state. All we know is he's apparently going to have a chat with Warren Gatland, apparently. So, I mean, Fred, just going to you first on this. Do you think that Warburton, if he says that I can start and I'm feeling fit and I'm ready to play, do you think he should play? That's the question, though.
I mean, I think he should play tomorrow, certainly. I think he plays tomorrow, see how it goes, and worst comes to worst, he can miss the first test. I mean, then again, it's my belief that losing him would not necessarily be the worst thing in the world. We have so many back rowers who can take his place. I mean, people considered that he might not even be on the tour at all, let alone captain it. There are so many people in the back row who can take his place. Haskell played well. He was one of the only players who seemed to have a decent game against the Blues. You got the Irish back three. Moriarty is one of the other injury concerns, but if he's able to overcome his back spasms, he's another contender. So The only thing I feel like you lose with Warburton if he's not fit is possibly his leadership and mentality, or the leadership he brings on the field, which we can't really judge from not being on the field ourselves. But I think there are, again, also in that regard, I think there are other people who can take his place.
Hi, I'm Matt Lawson, Nottingham alumni, now in Notts County Football Club, and you're listening to URN.
But we're now going to move on to an event a bit more closer to home. We've gone right away from round the world, and now we're going to go back to covering something that occurred just a bit further north from here, and that was, of course, in Leeds this weekend. There was the triathlon events that occurred, where professionals and non-professionals, of course, could compete. And amongst those competing and the winners of the triathlon were the UK's very own Brownie brothers, who had a fantastic display from the pair of them. It was great to see that they were back, that they have got themselves back into the swing of things. It's the first event they've competed in for quite some time, actually, since the World Championships in Mexico. And the event ended up finishing with Alistair Brownie walking away victorious, as has happened so many times against his younger brother Johnny. He must be getting a little bit sick of it potentially, but Alistair Brownie won the men's. Meanwhile, it was Bermuda's Flora Duffy who won the women's event. A really great event to be going on, both to promote sports, sort of to see the professionals competing, and also to see, obviously, the non-professionals taking part. But I think when we have to start off, probably the first place we have to look, I think, Alex, is obviously to those two brothers from Yorkshire.
I mean, I personally don't know much about triathlon, but I know a lot about the two Brownlee brothers. I mean, they are national, from their successes in many Olympics, they are national treasures, and it was really good to see them win once again, or come first and second once again, especially in their own home city of Leeds, which has produced many of our fine athletes in Yorkshire. So yeah, it is always good to see these two be successful, especially after the most recent race they were in. I think it was Johnny who was struggling?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. He was carried over the line by
his brother. Yeah, he was very sacrificed his own time to help out his brother, which kind of shows the camaraderie between the two. And obviously Johnny does tend to come out second, but there doesn't seem to be any bitterness between the two, and they know that they are the two pretty much most successful triathlonists in recent times.
Yeah, it is fantastic to see this kind of this 1-2 pairing that we get so often with these with the brothers, and they work so well together in tandem as a team. But they do, like you said, have that kind of the friendly rivalry between them, I think it's safe to say. I mean, afterwards, Alistair, when he was speaking to the press, said that his brother is the better of the two when it comes to the cycling and also to the swimming. He is the stronger, but he knows that when it comes to the long distance bit at the end, that's where he can often take his brother. So it's really interesting, and just sort of, I mean, as an event as a whole, I mean, for those two guys, you know, local boys in Leeds, where they, you know, they grew up and they're competing there at Nottingham, just sort of like, as you know, we've touched a couple of times on kind of like, you know, the legacy of sport. You know, these two are one of the endearing legacies of things like, for example, 2012, and the idea of, you know, these homegrown athletes when they're competing in events at home. Do we think that this is sort of where we see sport once again resurge in the British public's opinions? It has, athletics especially, it has sort of declined a little bit, obviously, in the lull periods we have between each Olympics.
Yeah, completely, because you don't hear so much about athletics. Like, it's not one of the main sports like football and cricket. I just think it's nice to see, especially in their hometown in Leeds, them doing what they do best, coming first and second. Like, the parents must be delighted for them, and it's just an incredible achievement after what happened last year for Johnny to come second again and finishing the race off himself, just not so far behind his brother, and Alistair obviously winning. It's incredible. And also, four of the top five in the men's event were British, so it just shows that the British are doing something right, because we're doing really well in the triathlon at the moment, and it's really nice to see.
Yeah, I've got to say, as we just mentioned, the athletics isn't the biggest event throughout the years, and it's only really when the Olympics comes around it gets, and maybe the World Championships potentially when it gets its recognition. But I'll say, when the triathlon is one of the more popular events, I mean, it combines three different events. I mean, running, swimming, and
cycling.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, so it kind of does get a bit of best of both worlds in that sense. And it's good to see not only triathlon getting more attention because of Britain's success, but obviously Britain succeeding in general.
Yeah, it is. It is fantastic to see this is continuing at such high level. I mean, one thing that I think when these sort of these events when they're occurring in these cities as well is the fact that we do then get so many non-professionals also competing. I think there's, you know, quite a lot of people that train quite hard for these events, and when they get to compete, obviously, you know, you're setting your own personal best, and it's a great achievement, and it is one of the endearing legacies of sport. I know it's been something which we've touched on a bit over the show throughout the course of the years. How much did London 2012 and Rio 2016 really have an impact? But things like this, thing where we see these events and you've got, you know, national heroes competing in these tournaments, that's where you really get to see it at its height. And like Naomi touched on there as well, Adam Bowden and Tom Bishop, they also came in the top five, so a four-way dominance for Britain in the men's. Are we then looking potentially at, I mean, a new era of British dominance in triathlon? I mean, I say a new era, obviously it's been going on now for potentially 5 years, if you argue with the Brownies, but with Adam Bowden and Tom Bishop coming up as well, are we now looking at further additions to the strength we have?
Yeah, I think that's the best thing about it. I mean, we've always associated the triathlon with our successes being the two Brownlees, but it's good to see others now getting very respectable positions, and hopefully potentially maybe might even start to challenge the Brownlees. I think it makes sport more interesting when it's not dominated by two people, if not one person. So yeah, it's always good to see Britain succeeding, and it's making it looks like it's going to be our kind of a golden generation in the sport.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's like nice to see more competition. You've got one Spanish athlete in between, but hopefully, like in the Olympics, there's a potential for a gold, silver, bronze finish for Britain, and also in the women's triathlon, the top British athlete finished sixth, which also isn't bad. It's a very respected position, and hopefully we'll keep improving in the triathlon.